To 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. Coming up next, a very different version, well, the intro at least, of the show that you're used to.
Wing Radio with Mike Koenig and my conversational compatriot and engineer, Egberto Willis. 90.1 FM Houston. Tonight is going to be open forum, 713-526-5738. I want you folks to know that up until like 5 p.m. tonight, I actually had a guest that was going to be on. And we were going to talk about something interesting, the fact that and we're going to probably do this in January, the fact that medicine is basically unisex. You didn't know that, did you? You never really thought about that. Medicine is basically designed for men. And women are considered to be, well, men are considered the medical default, and it's just assumed that women will react the same. And apparently that's not the case. So I had a doctor who was going to be on and talk about that. But man, this has been a news week. So I had guests last week, and I kind of decided we need to talk. I think we need to talk. So we're going to do that other show probably like the second week in January, and tonight it's just you and me and Egberto. 713-526-5738. So police, demonstrations, black people getting shot, armed, unarmed, maybe armed, not armed. We've had some distressing legal decisions. The chokehold death of the gentleman in New York. I'm sorry, what was his name again, Egberto? I had that written down, but I had some problem with my computer notes.
His name was, or is, you know, why did you do that to me? I forgot it as well. I'm going to get it for you.
Garner.
Eric Garner.
Okay, yeah. I had some computer problems over the last couple of days. I actually spent 2 hours just waiting for the computer to, like, wake up. So I had wonderful notes. And now the notes I'm working on are the same notes that you can see on my webpage at thinkwingradio.com, tonight's show announcement. I actually ended up having to copy-paste those notes for myself instead of all the other notes that I had, which is really annoying. But, you know, computers, can't live with them, can't kill them. So we had that decision of the chokehold on Mr. Garner. Mr. Garner was asphyxiated. He died from inability to breathe because of the chokehold. Apparently, the New York City coroner ruled it a homicide. Now, I'm going to get very specific here in terms of language. A homicide, technically, is anything that kills a person. Technically. When you, like, insecticide, that C-I-D-E, that simply means it's a killer or a death. And the H-O-M-I part is from Latin, meaning human or man. So a homicide is a man killing. And that can be very, very broad. It's tricky to get too involved in words. But I think that any reasonable person, if you use the reasonable person standard, I think any reasonable person would say that selling individual untaxed cigarettes is certainly not a capital crime. And by for some reason which I cannot fathom, the police seriously overreacted. Mr. Garner was a little belligerent. He was a little impatient, but he never raised hands. He got touched by the police first. He never threatened. He never raised hands. So I think one of the questions that a reasonable person asks is, why didn't they give him a ticket? Why didn't they give him a citation? Is there something about this particular crime, individually untaxed cigarettes, that makes this a sufficiently serious misdemeanor that he had to be arrested, that he had to be manhandled? I don't know. That's a question. Maybe somebody has that answer for me. 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. We have open lines. Mayor Bill de Blasio in New York, when he heard about the grand jury decision not to make any charges against the policeman who committed the act, I read a bit in the LA Times. It says de Blasio said he viewed the death of Garner, a black man, at the hands of a white officer as something personal. The mayor is married to a black woman. They have biracial children, including a teenage son, Dante. The mayor says, I've had to talk to him for years about the dangers he would face as a black teenager, especially when involved with police. That's from Mayor Bill de Blasio of New York City. Now, interestingly, on the other side, in Cleveland, Ohio, you have white and Latino police officers, apparently 9 Cleveland, Ohio police officers, who are suing the city of Cleveland, claiming racial bias. Now, this is an interesting twist, and I'll basically read what I took out of the article. This is white and Latino police officers claim racial bias after Cleveland shooting, LA Times. 9 Cleveland police officers, 8 whites and 1 Latino, are suing the city alleging racial discrimination, saying they were disciplined more harshly than black officers were in cases involving officer shootings. The 9 are seeking damages for lost pay, overtime, and other benefits in the wake of a November 29, 2012 high-speed car chase, during which, and this is kind of mind-blowing, 13 officers fired 137 rounds at 2 unarmed black civilians in a school parking lot. Obviously, there's a whole lot more to this story than that, but at the end of the day, we're talking about 137 bullets fired at 2 unarmed black civilians, apparently after a high-speed car chase, and they got cornered. 137 rounds. The suit alleges that the city of Cleveland has a history of treating non-African-American officers involved in the shootings of other African-Americans substantially harsher than African-American officers. So basically, white and Latino officers, they're claiming, are treated harsher than black officers in the event of the shooting of a black person. Then there was another bit. The 12-year-old young man, Tamir Rice, who apparently never had a chance to surrender, never had a chance to interact with the police. The only interaction he had was being shot. And apparently that officer, a 26-year-old rookie with the police department, was found to be unfit from his previous police job, apparently after just a few months. I don't know. I'm pro fairness. I'm pro justice. I'm basically pro police. I'm also anti-violence. I'm anti-abuse of human rights. I am pro-personal safety. I'm an old white guy. And I got to tell you, I am often made speechless now, hard for me, by the way, often made speechless now by just the mental confusion that I find myself having to wrestle with, trying to wrap my head around how this stuff happens. Egberto and I have, at this point, many discussions about just the oddity of white people walking around with semi-automatic rifles slung over their shoulders. And I think a lot of people find that very uncomfortable, but somehow they're not getting shot. You know, we had that thing with Bundy and his cattle, where you essentially had a bunch of white militia guys actually aiming rifles at U.S. government officers. And not a single person was shot. Not a single bullet was fired. But you've got two black people that are cornered after a high-speed chase, and 137 rounds are fired at them. You know, I'm a reasonable guy. I like to believe the best in people. I like to believe the best of cops. And every group has its bad apples, and I get that. But this is just, it's really, really hard for me to understand. Very puzzling. And I have people, I'm on Twitter, and every once in a while I get into a little conversational exchange on Twitter. And in addition to the people that I follow who are making very sympathetic comments about minorities and in their relationships with cops, it's also fascinating the number of people who send tweets to me who seem to be very, very much in denial. This stuff doesn't happen. They bring it on themselves. It's not just that they have a gun, because white people have guns and they're not getting shot. So it must be how they carry the gun. Or it must be using a gun in the commission of a crime. You know, a crime like taking it off the shelf and bringing it up to the cashier to buy and getting shot. But white people that go into Walmart, they are politely asked to leave with their AR-16s and other semi-automatic weapons. They're politely asked to leave without, you know, 45 bullets going through their bodies. I am very, very troubled. Okay, let's take our first caller. It'll just take a moment. Gary, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. It's been a little while. How have you been? Gary, you're on the air, I think.
We are addressing the racial aspects of these crimes.
Yes.
And we are not addressing the biological aspects of these crimes. Oh, wait a minute. There, I just took you off the speaker. Now I can hear you.
Excellent.
The fact is that people are people are people, okay? White people, black people, brown people, and people are basically biological entities, and we all have the same motivations. And I understand that Michael Brown got angry at the police officer because he told him to get out of the middle of the street. And then the police officer got angry at Michael Brown because he punched him in the face. And we all act like humans, don't we? I mean, we have to stop this racial definition and say, well, black people are, you know, they do more crime, and white cops, they kill more blacks. And you know, but, you know, the Islamic people are cutting heads off, and we need to realize that we're all human, and we all have the basic genetic motivation to be angry and violent and kill. And we need, if we took the racial aspect out of this discussion, we'd realize that we're all human beings, and we all behave the same. Wouldn't you agree?
I agree, and it's basically my feeling as well that people are the same all over. I've talked about watching Chinese and Korean soap operas, and with just some minor cultural variations and the fact that I can't understand what they're saying, they're not so different.
Well, the Chinese hate the Japanese, and the Japanese hate the Koreans.
And the Koreans aren't too fond of either one of them.
And the Indians hate the Pakistanis.
But here's the thing.
Well, come on. Now, we're all people, and we all react. And when, you know, if somebody was threatening you, you'd be afraid, and you might shoot them. And, you know, there is just basic human nature.
Okay,
I think.
Now we get into a different area. Because you talk about, well, if a white commits a crime, if a black commits a crime. Blacks are about 15% of the U.S. population, but they're 43% of the jail population, more or less.
Well, that's white, because of the drug thing.
No, because actually white kids use drugs as much as black kids. Black kids just go to jail for it more. That's a statistical truth. There's just no getting around that. White people with guns are less likely to be fatally shot than black people with guns. That is also a statistical truth. There's no getting around
that. Well, why are any of these people running around with guns?
Why are any of these white people running around with guns?
Exactly. And how many...
But they're not being killed in the same proportions to the population that black people, or disproportionate as the case may be, as black people. There is a fundamental question here that I, as a white person, and presumably other white people, are not getting. Now, I'm going to go this far. I don't think that black people are entirely blameless, because we all have to take some responsibility for the outcomes of our lives. I'm not saying that there isn't prejudice. I'm not saying there isn't prejudgment. I'm not saying there isn't excessive violence against minorities. But there is also something else going on. It's not just a white people problem. Now, the white people have the guns, and the white people have most of the cops, but it's not just a white people problem. Until we can somehow have a meeting of the minds, and really, I am genuinely perplexed about it. It makes me stutter. It really does. There is something racial and maybe genetic and maybe very subconscious. I don't think everybody is a white racist. I don't think everybody is a white supremacist. But there's something in people at a very primitive, basic level that they're acting on, that their higher intellectual faculties are somehow not able to recognize and moderate. Can you see anything of what I'm saying?
I do, and it's punctuated equilibrium. It's basic biology. We are tribal animals. And different tribes of chimpanzees will attack other tribes, and they say that was the origin of war. And if you notice that all human beings, including the Native Americans, would attack each other and each other's tribes and steal their women and murder their men, and it is biology. It is the basic reality of genetics that we are always against the other, and it doesn't matter if it's our neighbor. I've been having a lawsuit against my neighbor, and he's white, and I'm white, and we hate each other. And it's the tribes in Africa, and the tribes in the Middle East, and the tribes in Arabia, and the Mongolians, and the Chinese, and the Vietnamese, and the Koreans, and the Japanese.
All right, well, we can go through all the countries.
Well, what I'm saying is we are looking at the short picture here. We're not looking at the big picture. We're looking at, this black guy attacked a white guy, and a white guy shot the black guy. But it is basic human reality, and we need, until we address that, until we say, well, we are all human, and we are all the same, basically, and get over this tribalism, and the Palestinians and the Israelis and the Pakistanis and the Indians.
Okay, Gary.
So do you understand what I'm saying?
I hear you, but let me ask you a favor.
Step up to the next level of reality. How are we going to fix this?
Let me ask you a favor. I have two other callers. I've got Drew, who's been waiting now for 11 minutes. I've got Tim, who apparently is on a short leash.
All right, well,
If you want to call back later, depending on the flow of phone calls, you're more than welcome to, but I feel I need to give them their shots.
In other words, you don't have an answer to my proposal.
I don't know that there's a proposal. I think it's just human nature. If Egberto says if you'd like, we can put you on hold for a little while.
No, I'm okay. I want to hear you guys.
Okay, I appreciate it, and I appreciate your calling and your thoughts. Right. It's always fun.
Look at the big picture, will you?
Yes, sir, the big picture.
Yes, sir.
Okay, Drew, I am going to ask your indulgence for a couple more minutes. I'm going to take Tim, if Tim is real short, and then we're going to get to Drew. Tim, you're on the air. So all what's right. the rush?
Well, it's just I'm in the middle of trying to get some chores done and get over to my folks' house because I need to get over there.
That's okay. All right. So what's on your mind? You're on the air.
I agree with Gary quickly that, human nature is human nature no matter who you are. I agree with that 100%. As far as it goes with those who are in a position to allow their human nature to circumvent what they are there to do, that is not acceptable, if you understand what I'm saying.
I understand what you're saying. I am still perplexed as to how to judge it and how to correct it, how to overcome what seems to be a very innate tendency among a lot of people.
Nurture. I totally understand how difficult it would be, even if I were in that position, to rein in my natural tendencies. Mm-hmm. However, if you're going to be in that job, you must be able to. And since I need to be fairly quick, the one thing that I have not heard anyone at all so far, maybe people have done this, but I have not heard anyone talk about the fact that there seems to be no training for law enforcement officers to learn to shoot to stop. Shoot to injure.
Yeah, that's...
Eliminate the possibility of the threat that is coming at you.
They...
Now, I understand if somebody's got a gun and they're firing at you, well, oh, okay. You're on your own, do your thing. But if you have pretty much who is an unarmed person who is threatening you, attacking you, has a knife in their hands, whatever, they've got a hoe, a rake, an axe, but they are not, like, within, 2 feet of you, then, good God, a shoulder is not that much smaller, than a head.
I'll tell you what, Tim, I will address that, but I need to go to Drew because I jumped
in. Yeah.
Him.
No. I've been thinking about this for a long time, and I had to get that off my chest.
Okay.
Shoot to stop.
We'll talk about that. Thanks for calling.
Bye.
You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig and Egberto Willis, 90.1 FM in Houston. We have open lines, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. Drew, you're a gentleman and a scholar. Thank you for waiting. So what's on your mind tonight?
Thank you, guys. From listening to the conversation, the thing about why did the Mr. Eric kid have to be handled the way he was? Because it was a fishing expedition. If you find a kid selling cigarettes, hey, there's a chance he might have something that I can get a real conviction off of. So let me rifle through his pockets. Well, the only way to do that is to get a hold of him. If I write him a ticket, I don't get to touch him. If I don't get to touch him, I don't get to check his pockets and his socks, hoping to accidentally find something he's not supposed to have. So that's why every time you ever come in contact with a cop, coming from a lower middle-class background, the first thing they do is, well, let me see what's in your pockets. Well, get out of the car and let me check the car. It's always that because it's a fishing expedition. It's not, oh, well, let me write you a ticket for driving 5 over the speed limit. It's what else am I going to find so that it looks better?
Now, I understand what you're saying. You're not necessarily wrong. When a cop sees a traffic violation, and understand from a cop standpoint, and I've mentioned this before, the two most dangerous things they do are traffic stops and domestic complaints. Those are the two most dangerous things a cop does. On the other hand, what you say is correct. When they see a tail light out, or you didn't signal for a turn, or you rolled through a stop sign in a rolling stop, that is not only an opportunity for them to stop you and give you a ticket and make their goal or quota or whatever euphemism their managers want to call it, It's also an opportunity to see if, well, maybe this person has some outstanding warrants. Maybe this person has a gun in the front seat. Maybe this person has some drugs in their car. They get to look over the car. Now, I have to tell you, I've been stopped a few times in my life. I've never had them go through my pockets. I don't know what the difference is, but it's a really interesting question now. Now, may I ask your ethnicity, Drew?
I happen to be white, but I also happen to come from a very poor family. And so maybe part of it is, oh, hey, look, it's 2000, and he's driving an 88 Chevy Celebrity. We should go through his pockets.
Okay, so now that's interesting because that raises the question of where is the boundary line between a problem because you're black and a problem because you're poor when statistically so many blacks are poor. So now you're talking about teasing apart details.
Well, I believe personally, and this is a personal opinion, that while some portion of it is obviously poverty, I think another portion of it is an ingrained portion of white privilege. And the reason I say that is because we're talking about, well, why is it that these things end up predominantly being enforced on our peoples of color in this country. And why are these things being predominantly enforced on the peoples in this country that happen not to be of the makeup of the people in power? Well, I understand that you said that it's not all the fault of those individuals. It's not my fault that there's white privilege. But at the same time, it's also not that poor black mom's fault that she's struggling to make ends meet. And her kid looks like a poor kid.
And a poor black kid, so
right,
two-time
right.
loser.
Right, just to double it up and make it even, yeah. An even less positive, yeah, to throw that in on top. And then to also say the culture or some portion of the hip-hop culture doesn't necessarily promote, let's be friends with our local cops. Bear is awesome.
Yeah, not so much.
So when you have that confluence of an internalized and externalized white privilege, which even that poor white or that poor black lady and her son or whatever child she has are going to feel internal and external. On top of that, you also have that codified into law. And then you also have that, selected out with all the other stuff going on because of, you happen to be poor and there's white privilege and, the other things.
Drew, where did you pick all this up? I'm curious, because you said you're a white guy, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, how old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
I just turned 33.
Okay, and...
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, yeah.
Now, thank you.
Now, are you from here in Houston, or...
Yes, sir.
And where do you watch your news? What information... the reason I'm saying this is I'm very impressed, okay, with the tonality of your... And the intellect of your conversation.
He's been doing a lot of jazz fingers while you've been talking.
Right. I'm just surprised. Where did you get all of this from?
Well, I am a Pacifican. I'm a member, all that other stuff. I do listen to a lot of NPR, too, as well. But, honestly, I guess to me it's like I don't understand why this, like you guys, I don't understand why other people aren't seeing this.
Well, let me tell you why.
The way it is. Well, because all these confluences add on top of each other.
I don't want to take too much of Mike's time here because.
Oh, no, that's okay.
But I just want to. I am just.
Anything that's interesting,
yeah,
I'm in favor.
I am just, sir, very impressed with you. Not only that, I'm impressed. I'm glad that you're a young man. You asked, why is it that a lot of people don't see this? The reason a lot of people don't see this is because people like you and Mike, meaning white men, older and younger like yourself, are the ones that have to be very helpful in this endeavor, because there was a study that I blogged about just last week that says racism and all these things are not intrinsic to one's being. It is something that is learned, and it's not only that it's learned, but it can actually be tempered, and they actually did experiments that showed how it's tempered, and it is sure in effect with you, my dear friend. So anyway, I'll leave this to Mike, and just thank you for the talk that you just gave. Okay, I hope a lot of Houston really listen to you, my friend.
There are a couple of also remarks I want to make. First of all, I think for me, I'm always wondering about stuff. I'm always curious about stuff. And coming from New York in the 1960s and 70s, race has been very much a top of mind issue for me for most of my adult life. And I think that for me, one of the things that clarified the problem was that young man, and I think this was a Lawrence O'Donnell video clip, and I'm surprised I haven't seen it more. a young man was going into a gas station, followed by a police car, went into the gas station to get gas, didn't even realize he was being pulled over. And the police car, the cop asked him to get out of the car, and he was very polite. Sir, what's the problem, sir? Did I do something wrong? Cop said, well, one of your taillights is out, I believe it was. And he said, I'm sorry, I had no idea. And he said, okay, I'd like to see your ID. Can you get me your driver's license? Now, at this point, this young black man is outside the car. And I've said this before, it's like you always figure when you watch a show like Cops, it's when they get belligerent that the cops start to really bust them up. This guy was not belligerent. He was as polite and courteous and respectful as anybody I've ever seen, as I have been at times I have been stopped. He went into the car. Now, you can say that he obeyed promptly, or as the cops said, he lunged. Depends on a point of view. And as soon as this guy came out with his wallet, he got shot in the leg. That's all he did, was reach into the car for his wallet. So this cop was already on a hair trigger. He was already expecting the worst. And even after the kid was shot, it's, I'm sorry, sir. What did I do, sir? Why did you shoot me, sir? And it's like, it's heartbreaking.
My dad was a cop until his health couldn't prevent him from doing so. And my dad always told me that cops have a certain mentality because basically they're adrenaline junkies. The whole lights and siren thing amps them up so hard that after a couple years, anything other than that isn't enough stimulation. And so the whole thing about them being itchy, yeah, they do a really dangerous job, but it's also the adrenaline junkie part of it. Well, so my dad always told me, having been a cop, the first thing you do is put your wallet in your right hand, insurance in your left, and put both wrists on the steering wheel. Well, number one, we shouldn't have to train people how to engage cops that way.
I've been doing that since I was 18.
We shouldn't have to. We just shouldn't. But for my dad to train me that as a white guy training his white kid, imagine how much training a black parent would have to give to their black child with all these other mountaintop things rolling down the hill on top of them.
So where does – I mean, obviously it's not a matter of walking or chewing gum. We have to deal with problems more or less simultaneously. But where is the problem in training the cops? Is the problem in humanizing the community for the cops? Is the problem that they need a daily Prozac before they go out? I mean –
Well, I honestly, the way I'm thinking about it and have off and on for a long time is you've got these guys that a lot of them are ex-military or didn't have, and I don't mean to be rude to our cops because we have to have them and they do a really specific function that we need.
Yes.
But a lot of them weren't the brightest kids in their class. They may or may not have been ex-military, so they already have that thought process in their mind. Then you only train them basically to an associate's degree level before you put them into the field. So this guy's taking basic math, maybe some basic science, some basic English, and you're like, okay, you get to make life and death decisions over random people in a spur of a second.
So what do they need, more humanities training? I mean, in a liberal education sense?
I mean, I'm not sure that it would hurt for sure, but I think the second part of it is, like the other gentleman said something about training them to not shoot for center body mass.
Yeah,
that's not going to happen. I'm sorry. I wish it would, but it's not going to happen.
I agree with you.
We give them tasers, and they won't even reach for the damn taser.
Explain, because I was going to, but since you've brought it up, explain about this concept of shooting for the center of mass and why that is how they are trained.
Aim small, miss small. If you aim for a small target, you're going to miss by just a little bit. If you aim for the biggest part of the body, you're not going to miss. Aim small, miss small.
Because the purpose when you draw a gun is what?
To stop an encounter,
yes.
Period.
Period.
Not to slow it down, not to hinder it, to stop it. The only thing that stops one human from doing something to another human is to put them down.
And what you notice when you do have a shooting is even with that training to shoot at the center of mass, you've got gun wounds in the hand and the forearm and the shoulder and the thigh, and they're aiming at the center of mass. That's how hard it is to do a shoulder or leg shot.
Well, like I said, these guys are amped up. I mean, I don't know if I've been pulled over before, most of us have. Just being in front of a car with blue lights and sirens just automatically elevates everything.
Yeah, just having the luck.
You know, so imagine if you're doing that and you're the guy on the other side of it. you know, you're shaking, sitting in the car, just having the guy come talk to you, and you know the only thing you maybe did wrong was being 4 or 5 over the speed limit or forgetting to signal, and you're nervous. Well, think about the guy on the other side of that who thinks, well, this guy might have a gun,
or whatever.
Well, of course, he's going to be even more amped up. So, yeah, his aim isn't going to be spot on.
Depending on how the conversations go, and I'm going to have to let you go, Drew.
Yes, sir. I appreciate it.
Have a great night, and thanks so much for calling. I think you made some really important comments. At some point, I'm going to get around to telling you folks about the first time I was ever stopped by the Texas Highway Patrol. At some point, I'm going to tell you that story. That's an interesting story. Freeman, I appreciate your patience. By the way, let me do a quick station ID. You're listening to KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig and Egberto Willows, who also, by the way, has his own show on Monday night at 9 o'clock, Politics Done Right. We only do politics, okay. So, Freeman, how are you doing tonight? You're on the air.
I'm doing all right. How about yourself?
Good, thank you. What you got?
That was good. Well, I had a couple of points I wanted to touch on, and actually you and the previous caller touched on them. Number one, I wanted to say that has anyone thought about it? And what I mean by that is has anyone thought about the fact that there, in this age we live in, there's a lot of video surveillance, you know, there's a lot of people with cell phone cameras, and there's a lot more footage being captured just of everything in general. So the fact that we're seeing a lot of footage of police brutality, are people thinking that this is a new thing, you know, like a new phenomenon, or is this just something that's been going on and it's just something that's coming to light here in 2013, 2014, so on and so forth?
I think it's like a lot of modern technology, whether it's diagnostic technology or video technology or surveillance technology. The more we can see, the more we see. So I think having dashboard cams on police cars has given us a lot more insight into what has always been going on with police. Mm-hmm. Body cams will do the same thing. I remember, I don't remember where I saw it. It was probably on Matto or O'Donnell. They had a police incident that occurred, and they had two points of view. They had a body cam on the police officer, and they had a dash cam in his car. Apparently, there had been a slow speed chase. The cop had been following this guy, white guy, and finally the guy pulled into his driveway, and the cop blocked the driveway, and the dash cam now captured what happened, but both the driver and the cop were on the other side of the perp's car from the dash cam. So a lot was obscured. What you see is the cop is interacting with the driver is interacting with the cop. It's all very cordial and polite, and all of a sudden there's a tussle. And it looks like the cop assaulted the guy for no obvious reason and eventually subdues him. When you go to the body cam, it turns out that in the middle of this very polite and cordial interaction, the driver of the car went for the cop's gun. That's what you see from the body cam. You couldn't tell that from the dash cam. So I think that for a lot of cops, for the good cops, and I think that's most of them, this actually could end up saving their lives and their careers, having body cams. But it's the more you see, the more you know, because now you can see it and before you couldn't. It used to be we tested chemistry for parts per hundred, parts per thousand. Now it's parts per million, parts per billion. So we get nervous about the parts per billion we can see when we used to be fine with one part in 10,000.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, I think that that's the point.
I definitely think it's something that has been going on, of course. You know, police brutality is nothing new, although I feel like a lot of Americans maybe think that it's something that's escalating or something that's on the rise. I really don't think so. I think it's just coming to light more and more.
I agree.
And I can't imagine that that's a bad thing. It has to be a good thing. I think, you know, we just need to just deal with it and realize that this is something that people are dealing with every day, especially young minority men and women, and I'm sure even children to some degree.
And now we know the meaning of the NBC blurb, the more you know.
There you go.
It's all about the more you know. Thank you so much for calling.
Okay, yeah, I don't want to take up too much time, but some of the other points that I wanted to touch on was...
Okay, we're going to have to do the Reader's Digest version then. Just touch on them quick.
Okay, no problem. Number one, the previous caller did mention a lot of the police officers, especially the young guys these days, are ex-military, so that is something...
And combat military.
About, you know, yeah, like, are these the type of people that are best qualified to be law enforcement? I don't know. I don't think so, me personally. The other thing was you actually... said you saw that video. I was going to mention that. The video of the young man I saw on Facebook the other day reaching into the car very quickly for his wallet. He got shot, and the cop shot at him like 6 times. He's lucky to be alive, really. It's only by the grace of God that he lived through that.
And the last thing was probably shooting for the center of mass.
If you could elaborate on your point earlier about the, I think you said like an innate nature amongst people to be racist. Is that what you were trying to maybe say, or?
I think that's what Gary was trying to say, and as it happens, I think Gary may be calling back, so we'll probably get back to that topic again.
All right.
Thank you so much, Freeman.
No problem. You have a good night.
Thank you. You too. Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point about, you know, military and police, total different training. And when we used to have a draft, you had a lot of diverse experience and a lot of diverse personality types in terms of that military experience. I'm not necessarily saying we should have a military draft, but I think that having someone who has been trained in counterinsurgency and street-to-street, house-to-house combat, I think that there may be a different mentality there that maybe rather than qualifying them for police work, maybe should disqualify them for police work. Because you have to untrain them.
It's amazing what is about to happen with all the people from Iraq that saw that kind of carnage. It means nothing to them when they come over here. So, I mean, if we think that they'll make good police, we have a good thing thinking here.
Yeah, there's actually a whole other topic that ties into about the virtues or not of having an all-volunteer military and having 99% of the population having nothing to do with it. I mean, we could go back to ancient Rome, how that worked out for them. Not so good. Okay, Chris, I believe you're next. By the way, we have open line 713-526-5738. Chris, so how are you doing tonight? You're on the air.
I'm doing fine. How are you gentlemen doing?
Good, thank you.
I'd like to make a point. I think that the gentleman was a little bit askew when he was speaking about the previous caller's comment about tribalism as opposed to racism. You can look at a place like Ireland where something as slight as a slight division in the Christian church, there's no visible definition of the people there that you could say
they
on other than
an act.
Correct, and you could do that same micro environment anywhere around the earth. As a matter of fact, anyone who looks at history and one of the tactics of colonization is obviously to go into a place, into a group of land, find the ethnic minority, and empower them against the majority and take away what the majority has. It was the same, you know, colonial directive all throughout Africa, Asia. Anywhere like that. So that's been utilized throughout history, that base. But it's more of a tribal thing. I believe that among the Bedouins, there's a saying, me against my brother, me and my brother against our cousin, me and my brother and our cousin against the neighbor, and all of us against the foreigner.
I have heard that. That's a great phrase.
Yeah. As far as military, being ex-police, and the whole theory of another gentleman about adrenaline junkies and stuff like that, being a person who engages in... I guess what would be termed as high adrenaline activities. It's not so much of an addiction. I wouldn't put it as that, as a mindset. I mean, it's not something that, I brag about, but it's something that I find that I naturally gravitate towards. And the longer you engage in those type of activities, actually the more clarity of thought you're able to acquire in those type of situations. And I think that, for instance, someone who's been in Afghanistan and has had to patrol in a hostile environment and had to deal with people of a complete different cultural background could potentially be an asset here coming to deal with something like that. On the flip side, I realize there are those, and even among law enforcement community right now, I think that there should be heavily screening, a lot more screening, and I think that the idea of body cams and all recording devices in this day and age, with their accessibility and their price, being such a greatly reduced, it's ridiculous that all law enforcement in the U.S. is not equipped with such equipment.
I'm curious, in your opinion, do you think that civilians trained to be police make better police, or do you think ex-military, that you have to untrain from their military training and then train to be civilian police, make better police?
There's so many variables in the situations. I've known great law enforcement officers that were completely civilian, and law enforcement was a career that they went to directly out of college. And I've known great law enforcement officers that were ex-military from all backgrounds, even ex-military that didn't involve combat experience, to those guys who saw, you know, to my uncle, in fact, who served three tours of duty in Vietnam, was a Galveston County Sheriff's officer, was a Border Patrol agent in the area of Eagle Pass in the 1970s, when it was very, very, well, it was actually that the area that he patrolled in the United States as a Border Patrol agent was the area that saw the most gunfire incidents in any law enforcement type, federal, state, or local, across the United States, was his area. So, and he made a wonderful police officer, was the most calm, level-headed individual that you would ever want to meet. You know, a great man. So, and like I said, we're human beings. We have such a vast array that to try and narrow these things down, you know, that defeats us as a human. That defeats progress in
well,
this area.
Well, it's always dangerous to generalize. So obviously,
yes,
not every civilian is going to make a good cop, and not every ex-military is going to make a bad cop. But in business, when a company wants to try to change their culture, they hire from outside, and sometimes preferentially people with no experience, so that they can train that person the way they want instead of trying to untrain them from what they've learned and then train them for what they want. And maybe that's something that police departments need to be thinking about when they go through their screening processes.
No, sure. And like I say, the idea of cameras would eliminate so much of this.
I think in the long run it would be a plus for both the cops and the civilians, because I think it would get them out of jams. You know, we would have a much clearer understanding of what happened with Michael Brown if Darren Wilson had been wearing a body cam.
Yeah, and taking things from like I said, I have family here, and I have family here on the frontera of Texas and Tamaulipas and Coahuila, and in those places of my family that are involved in law enforcement down there, you cannot generalize someone. You cannot go up to a 1988 Chevrolet pickup truck with guys in it that look like they are farmers or ranchers and assume that these guys are farmers and or ranchers.
Yeah.
You know, that it is sad to say that.
But you know what?
Everyone is a blank slate, and they can read subtleties in these people that I've, you know, in this culture that, you know, I couldn't fathom.
But
and
you know, in order to gain that experience, it's like in my personal life, because I've worked in people's homes, because I've worked in retail, I have literally interfaced with thousands and thousands of people. And I have to keep relearning from time to time not to make assumptions based on a first impression.
Exactly.
It's a very, very hard thing to keep reminding yourself. I'm going to tell one quick story, and then I'm going to let you go, Chris. When I was working once for a retailer, I guess this was about 15 years ago, something like that. And I was working in an electronics department, and a man came in, a black man. He was in clothes. He had a lot of paint on his clothes. He looked like he was a painter who had just come off work from new construction. So he was looking for a cell phone, and I didn't expect to, it's not a commission job, but nonetheless, you have incentives, and I didn't expect to make much of a sale. But I was courteous to him. He seemed like a pleasant enough fellow, and I was courteous to him. It turned out that he bought like $3,000 worth of merchandise, various electronics, cameras, and stuff. Turned out he was a doctor. He was covered with paint because he had been working in his barn all day. He had several acres. And now he was looking to get some communication equipment to talk between the barn and the house, and he wanted to have like a washing machine in there. And this was a big deal. This was a very affluent guy, and that was not my first impression of him. And I was courteous to him, and later it was like, oh, it's nice that I was courteous to him because he spent a lot of money and he wasn't what he looked like when he came in. But this is me knowing better than that.
Well, and anyone who's been in that line of work and has been in a success in that line of work, I can tell you, has the same story. I have a friend of ours who is involved in selling tractors. Same thing. Guy comes in, dirty overalls, tore, greasy stain. Nobody wanted anything to do with him. You know, guy bought three John Deeres and cash for him. Anyone who's been a success and spent the time in that vein of work has a similar story.
And it's fascinating because you have to learn it over and over, it seems.
Yes, sir. I would like to leave you with one comment, and I'd ask y'all, if y'all had heard about the murder in the Serbian community in St. Louis, the young gentleman that was attacked by a group of men with hammers, young teenagers.
Where was that?
In St. Louis, I believe. Huh. And my point is that this was a very brutal killing. But yet, for some reason, our media is so polarized right now, this will not. And my fear is that things like this get drowned out. And I'd like you gentlemen to think about something. You know, there's been a lot of talk about civil rights and things like that, but I want people to remember that when Martin Luther King was killed, he wasn't just organizing black Americans. He was organizing poor Americans to march on Washington.
Yeah.
And that was probably the biggest threat of all.
That's actually like the Shirley Sherrod story, where she had to learn it wasn't about white people and black people. It was about people with money and people without money.
Yes, sir. I'll let you gentlemen finish up the program. You are doing some great work.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your calling, Chris. Okay, Egberto, is that Gary from earlier tonight? So should we take Randall or Gary? I think Randall hasn't had a shot yet. We'll try to leave some time for Gary so he can kind of get his last word in tonight, if that's okay with Gary, I hope. Randall, we're going to take you next because you're a first-timer tonight. How you doing tonight? You're on the air.
Well, I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
So I've been listening to this, and I just want to say the human experience throughout history has been fear. Fear of what we don't know, and it would help if we'd get to know each other a little better.
I think that's the best reason to have, even if necessary, forced integration, so that people that are strange to you become more familiar to you and more human.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I was growing up, my father said, I forbid you to play with those boys, and so I went ahead and did it anyway.
You're a good boy, Randall.
And some of my best friends were black, like a black saxophone player and a black piano player, and we hung out. And then my father left when I was 12, and I didn't see him again until I was 21. But I still have my friends.
Yep.
And the only person that ever pulled a gun on me was white.
We all have to learn these lessons in so many different ways. We all have our own stories about how that epiphany came to us.
But still, I think it's not a question of we're so different from each other. I think it's a question of what we don't know, we fear.
I think that that's true, and I think that's actually the point that Gary made earlier.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'm going to let Gary get in a couple of words, but I appreciate your calling, Randall, and I appreciate your hearing about your experience.
All right.
Have a good night.
You too.
Okay, Gary, you're back.
Oh, good golly, there have been so many new subjects, I don't know what to speak about.
Oh, just throw a dart at something.
Okay, the media. I'll throw a dart at the media.
Oh, that's one we haven't much covered.
Okay, and we got four incidents of whites shooting blacks, law enforcement killing people without weapons in Cleveland and in Ferguson and in New York. And, you know, that's what the media focuses on. They don't mention the 800,000 black people that went out and didn't have a confrontation with the police. They don't mention the 8,000 white police officers that didn't have a confrontation with a black citizen. And if we keep separating the black and the white, then we're never going to get to an answer. It has nothing to do with black and white. It has to do with being human beings. That is all I have to say.
Okay. Hold on a second, and let me do the quick ID, because, again, I'm late. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig and Egberto Willis, 90.1 FM in Houston. Egberto, you had a comment?
Yeah, I love Gary, and Gary lives in a world that I want to live in. Unfortunately, that isn't the world that we live in. And Gary is correct that the media kind of puts a whole lot on these things.
Good news is no news.
Yeah, exactly, but the reality is behind the scenes, and I can tell you, Gary, that I live it. You know, it's there is a problem, and the problem is, I mean, we don't want it to be racial. You're a good guy, and that's why you want to see things through your eyes. But I can tell you, my friend, there is a problem, and we have to look at it racially, else we won't solve the problem unless we take the bull by the horns. And Mike, it's all yours.
I think that there is a point, though, that Gary has made and others have made about tribalism. And the question is, how do you define your tribe? One of the things that I've said for many, many years is that it's very peculiar to me that the United States is such a sports-oriented country, and everybody is for their team, but we don't see everyone in our country as our team. So we can't trade the weak guys. So what you really want to do is you want to use their talents as best you can so that your team gets better. And why is it that we can't get the concept of team or tribe, however you want to term it, to be big enough to encompass many different kinds of people? Why do we keep wanting to make that tribe as small as possible?
There's an answer to that.
Have you got it?
Well, Edward O. Wilson has it. It's called genetics. It's called evolution. It's the way we evolved. We are tribal. That's how we survive.
I think there comes a point, though, where that becomes an excuse. I mean, I don't underestimate the power of genetics. But, you know, trying to separate nature versus nurture, one of the comments I make, and it may or may not be true, but I think it's somewhat true, is you have football players, professional football players. These guys are aggressive guys. You have football players, linemen, who talk about they really love that crunch when they hit somebody. They like feeling the impact. They like hurting other people. And those people, in different circumstances, might have ended up being criminals, and they could have ended up in prison. But they ended up being put to a place, guided to a place through their environment that society values. So nature is a big part of it. You have highly aggressive guys who make millions of dollars versus highly aggressive guys who are languishing in prison for 20 years.
And you have highly aggressive guys that are part of the 1% because they were aggressive about money and not physical violence. It's perhaps the nature of the beast.
Perhaps so. All right, I think we need to wrap it up for tonight. We're getting close to the end. I appreciate your calling back, Gary. We've had a good discussion tonight, and I hope maybe we've opened some minds and gotten some neurological juices sizzling there. While we have, I guess, a few seconds, let me just point out that in 2009, this is an interesting statistic. I got this from a 2009 report, FBI expanded homicide data. In 2009, 24.2% of victims were slain by family members. 53.8% were killed by someone they knew, an acquaintance, neighbor, friend, boyfriend. And the relationship of murder victims and offenders was unknown in 43.9% of those cases. So the truism that usually victims are the victims of somebody they know, statistically valid. Okay, everybody, have a great week. I'll see you or hear you or listen. You'll listen to me next week. And as Jesse says, slower traffic, keep right. It's not just a good idea. It's the freaking law.
Three sad facts. All over the world, more than 80% of forest cover has been lost to deforestation. Topsoil is lost much faster than it's being created, and a half of all species are threatened with extinction, mainly by industrial activity. Until now, for the past 300 million years, about one species was going extinct every 4 years. But now, scientists see one species go extinct every 15 minutes. This environmental destruction can only be changed when you act. Deep Green Resistance says standing up and speaking out is the only hope for our planet. To learn more, visit deepgreenresistance.org. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
The following program may contain language or imagery that may be offensive to some listeners. Discretion is advised. Federal Communications Commission permits the broadcast of some profanity during hours deemed to be safe harbor, when children are less likely to be listening. KPFT upholds a stricter policy, permitting the broadcast of sensitive material only between the hours of midnight and 5 a.m. The FCC forbids the broadcast of some sexual discussions or other suggestive matters, regardless of the hour. If you have any questions or concerns, please call the program director during business hours at 713-526-4000. This is KPFT Houston.
Yeah, yeah. Eyes on Me Radio. We on live 11 o'clock to the dot, man. 90.1 Houston. Galveston 89.5. Goodrich Livingston 90.3. Huntsville 91.9. You already know what time it is. My man DJ Brio is waiting for you to call in. We have an interesting